Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Felicia.
My name is Julia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
We're covering Lady of Palenque, Flower of Bacall by Anna Kirwan.
Isn't she the lady who brought us the Queen Victoria one?
She did. And again, she has failed to write a summary for this book, so I've written my own. In pre-contact Mesoamerica, Yash Aushak keeps record of her travels as she leaves her homeland to embark on her marriage with a neighboring kingdom.
That's a pretty good summary.
Thank you.
Because if you had to go and summarize the plot of this book, it is road trip from hell.
I actually wrote down, this was like the Mayan Oregon Trail game. Our youth. Okay, before I get into all my jazz, do you remember reading this one?
Never read it, never saw it, never heard of her. I do not know her. We might have passed each other in the hallway. We never chatted. No, I didn't read this book.
Yeah, I definitely did not read this book. You know how I could tell, because when I first opened it, the crack of the book being like freshly opened.
It's
crack.
Oh. 10,000 years will give you such a crick in the neck.
Yeah, so now we have officially moved into Felicia is collecting these books because she wants to finish the collection project, not necessarily because she is still interested in reading these books.
Fair enough.
Okay, so what did you think about it, reading it?
It's not a poorly written book. I think it's actually quite well written for the most part. This woman is not super well known. We don't even have her actual name.
Mm-hmm.
So she's really trying to go and build up a story for a person who we don't have much, if any, personal information or personal stories about her.
Mm-hmm.
And on one hand, her going on the road trip from hell to go to her soon-to-be husband's kingdom is a little thin on the ground in some ways. Aside from the, you know, the points of, oh shit, things are going like sideways, not a lot of things happen in this book. It isn't like, you know, Cleopatra going on her road trip with her dad, father-daughter bonding time, and then having to deal with, like, the machinations of living in Rome and a completely different culture and, like, family dynamic and then going back and it's imploding. Or even with Nzinga, who also goes on a road trip and almost kidnapping from hell. But that's only, like, the last part of the book. It's not the whole thing. I think we could have had a little bit more than just road trip from hell.
Yeah, I think if she had had more opportunity to be at home, I think that would have opened up the potential to really understand more about what was day-to-day life like for the Maya people at this time. I think that was a missed opportunity because you don't really get a flavor for what things are like when someone's literally camping in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not how she would have been living her regular everyday life.
And even at the points where, you know, she's stopping by at different relatives' cities for periods and everything like that, because it's not a monolith, right? So where did she really go and come from? We don't really know.
I don't want to get too into, like, boorns on this book. I will say, though, I appreciate this book more having done the write-up and the research that I'm going to be sharing with you. So maybe after I'm done sharing this with you, you'll be like, oh, this is actually a better book than I realized. For me, it was the sort of lack of underpinning understanding and knowledge, the way some things were written about very familiar-wise in a way that I didn't understand. Like, for example, she'll say, Inta says, I have to blah, blah, blah. Now I have to remember who's Inta. Oh, wait, that's her father. Instead of saying my father Inta. Like, you could have done that a couple of times instead of just launching into the names. And the naming convention is accurate, but it is complicated and long and confusing at times. So I was getting confused about, is this a person? Is this a place? Is this a ritual thing? Like, what is this?
And also understand, like, I think any language, you have certain common words and groupings together too that will make up your naming conventions. So at one point I was like, wait a second, is this the guy that she's supposed to get married? There's a lot of similarities. Then I was like, okay, no spoilers. I'm like, but what's going on? Who is this person? person.
Yeah. So in no particular order, here were some standout things. So like I said, the Mayan Oregon Trail game, everybody's dying. So look out for that. I like the incorporation of why she was keeping the diary because it actually is accurate. She's going to be the record keeper slash scribe wife of this chief. And so the idea of that's why she's documenting this as sort of embarking on this journey. That is a good tie-in explanation of why the heck is she keeping this record. I like that.
Yeah. Can we talk really briefly about her husband, though?
Yeah, if you want.
I'm not down for cultural relativism in terms of, oh, that's just the way it was. Because it is, in the end, fundamentally, like, more than creepy that this guy in his early 30s.
He's 33 and she's 13.
Yeah.
However,
oh my God.
The very end, she does a little mirror signal thing and she gets a message back, and then you discover that it's actually your husband-to-be, and she has written throughout her little record all these sort of personal questions, like, does he like this? I'm wondering about him. Also, I really enjoyed her sentiment consistently being, I really hope this guy is worth all this shit I'm putting up with, because that would be my diary entries over and over again. But it is really, like, straight out of fanfic, where he responds to some of her questions and he's like, actually, such and such a food is my fave. And you're just like, oh, he read her record. I'm like, that's so cute. And then I'm like, wait, you're 33, she's 13. It's gross. However, if someone wanted to incorporate that into a age-appropriate romance novel between two adults, I'd be down for it. I think it's adorable.
Listen, the bar is, it like has gone past the South Pole and is like hanging down somewhere in like the middle of the universe for men. But the fact that he does go read her stuff and shows interest in her. And then I'm also sitting here being like, wow, oh no, he showed interest in his wife. Wow, what a great guy. I'm like, this is...
I thought it was a cute wrap up.
It's cute, but at the same time, though, I'm just like, oh lordy.
Oh, also, actual menstruation occurring. Even though all these girls are in puberty-esque age. Oh, cool.
Periods.
They happen.
Exactly.
All right. So a few women in this series, because of the time period, the fact that they're women, and obviously colonizing, there isn't a lot left on the record about Yash O'Shock. Her actual name isn't known. That's just the title. So talk about identity erasure. So she was a Mayan queen of Tikal and the wife of Yinkin Chen Kilwai. Her son, Yash Paj Chen Yopat, identified her by her name and title as a noble young reader or the young lord's counter. She's historically known as Chakni Yi, Lady of Palaquin, from the great family of Pakal the Great. She was the daughter of Lord Kinich Hanib Pakal II. Her only sibling was her brother that we know of, Kestel Jaguar, who is the lord of Alekma after his father. In her early teens, she was married. She bore a son. Her husband died in 762 AD after 13 years of marriage. Her young son was crowned Lord of Tikal. By the end of his reign, tension between upper and lower classes, as well as inbreeding among a number of small noble families, led to loss of the lord's influence in the common people. And shortly after, in the middle of the 9th century, the classic Mayan cities collapsed due to deforestation, soil depletion, drought, overhunting, overpopulation. So that's it. That's the end of the episode. Thank you for coming.
Wow.
JK, JK. But seriously, if you're annoyed about this episode not having enough information about this specific woman, then get angry about colonization, disease, and genocide that eradicate the stories of so many people in history. This eradication also continues to this day. So if we don't take the time to stop and listen to people's stories, because that is how history is made, it's also something that's not in the past and dead. It's something that's active and alive. We're having to get creative about this one. But I wanted to make sure two critical things come through with what I share. Number one, the history of the Maya people didn't start when the white people showed up. Number two, their history isn't over yet. All the emphasis about the mysterious ancient Maya from the History Channel gives a lot of people the very incorrect assumption that they're gone or mysteriously vanished. They are not. Also, GTFO with this ancient aliens crap. My favorite meme is, just because white people didn't make it doesn't mean it's aliens. There are a lot of directions I thought about taking this, but I decided to do almost a close reading, pulling certain passages and then telling you a bit more about those certain cultural pillars to give you more insights into Mayan culture.
Is this the part where we both go and say, what do we know about Maya culture before this episode?
Sure, go for it.
So I've watched a lot of El Salvadorian, a lot of Guatemalan contemporary cinema involving contemporary Maya people. So I did know that they were still around.
That's good.
Second of all, I have played Shadow of the Tomb Raider.
Oh my God.
And that is set in Central America. It's Yaxchel. I'm like, that's how he goes there. Or it's Ixchel. It's this moon goddess. I'm like, thank you, Lara Croft. With your pillaging ass.
Gosh.
So yeah, other than that, I mean, I don't know that much.
Yeah, I went on vacation trip and I was in the Yucatan province of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did get to do some cultural and historical trips and things like that. But it is very different when the background and the discovery that you can do on a trip versus when you're actually sitting down and learning and reading about these actual people who, because now in the modern context, is part of multiple nations. And it even at the time, they weren't a centralized government and there wasn't a centralized Mayan kingdom at any point.
Mm-hmm.
It was different city state ruler people.
Yeah.
So they're all very unique and very different in that way.
When I got to go down to Bolivia, we went on a tour and our indigenous tour guide said, hello, how many people think that the Maya are here? A couple of people in the thing, but he's like, wrong country. You can get back on the plane.
It's so true. Oh, man. Pro tip. Like I was saying about those sort of cultural pillars, these are relevant no matter where you go in the world. If you ever want to have access to understanding about what's this place like where I'm going to travel, think about these type of things to potentially read about before you go on the trip.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have a greater appreciation. Or if you find yourself hurtling back through time and you're in ancient Mayan times, you'll be okay because I've given you a crash course.
So pretty much if those ancient aliens...
If the ancient aliens are real and they zap you back in time, you're okay. Yeah, and it'll also prime me to be a better historian of the living history happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first, the value and understanding of time, the Maya calendar. Quote, they matched my horoscope with that of the firekeeper and announced that he and I will tie our cloaks together and eat together and I will be his new wife. Inta thinks Firekeeper's visions are of the next Bactoon, the new era. The swarming of people will be a migration of our children and grandchildren away from old hunting grounds. The cut down forests and water which will have been buried, they will seek new earth, new water, clean places to dwell, pray in a new purified age. So we tend to separate science and religious rituals because of enlightenment thinking, quote unquote. But that's no good here. Get rid of that.
Okay.
The Maya calendar is infamous for predicting the end of the world in 2012, but there is more than one calendar. They had one for measuring solar year called the Hab, the sacred calendar that represented the 9 cycles of the moon, and a calendar for events spanning over 52 years called the Long Count. The Hab was good for 365 days, but it measured out in 18 months, each had 20 days. It also had an additional month that was only 5 days, so they had 365 days.
Mm-hmm.
By interweaving these calendars, they made a calendar that produced in combination it wouldn't occur again for another 52 years. This is why elders who reached the age of 52 years were treated with extra respect. For that long calendar, counting the days in chronological order, it began on August 11th, and that's when the Maya believed was the mythological day of creation. This is why on December 21st of 2012, everyone's freaking out because of the calendar completing its full cycle. But instead of being a garbage media sensation about an apocalypse, we should have viewed it as a new cycle and rebirth for humankind. But we didn't, so now I think we are doomed.
Yes.
Fun fact, the Maya used their calendar to name their children. So each day corresponded with a name. So names were very unique to that individual. So things like Earthquake One and Rainbow Goddess.
Mm-hmm.
The sun traditions concerning time are very important throughout the land. Observations of the passage of the sun directly overhead twice a year allowed Maya to make very accurate calculations during the length of the solar year. They're accomplished mathematicians. They invented the concept of zero and recorded mathematical tables to predict solar and lunar eclipses. Their astronomers have the ability to predict and mark the passage of the seasons by observing the movements of the sun or in respect to their pyramids and other temples. So the sun and its cycles are foundational to this calendar.
You know what just occurred to me, but probably also contributed to the accuracy as well, is the fact that they're so close to the equator.
100%.
So they're not like our sorry asses where now it's getting dark at 7 o'clock.
I know.
Oh, God. Because we live in the frozen north.
Yeah.
But no, they have consistency.
Which is why they were able to keep their patterns of regulation so accurate. It's actually, it's not scary, but it is astounding when you think about how they would position the one temple so that right at the summer solstice or when the winter solstice would happen, half of the temple would be hit by the sun and the other half is in complete darkness. And right there, that is emblematic of that sort of everything is in balance and everything has like not a yin and yang, but it's the same principle of a circle of equality.
They probably also don't have seasonal affective disorder either.
No.
God.
So much vitamin D.
We gotta move to the Yucatan, man.
I know. Especially after we get into when we talk about the food.
Ooh.
Okay. So then we go from the calendar and timekeeping. And as I said, that blends into religion. Quote, "The world we live in is made of corn. We are made of maize, of corn. There was not always corn. Other worlds lived before this one. There was no corn, and our world began when the spirit of First Father went into the blood woman's hand like pollen from the best hill. She used it to make old grandmother's field yield enough corn to feed her son's children and their mother. When there was no family to work it, our world is sweeter than the worlds before." So in the Mayan creation myth, there were three creations, three levels. So the first level of creation, people weren't there. Second level, people weren't there. Third level, people are there. And people are born of corn. They were literally called the children of the corn.
And so, not in like the creepy children of the corn horror film.
No. Okay. However, they did admire / want to emulate the god of corn. So they would try to like shape their skulls to be long and narrow, like stalks of corn, which, you know, if you're doing that to a smushy, soft baby head, potentially could lead to
brain
damage and disfiguration and death. But that is like one of those identifying things where if you see in their statues or their reliefs, how like they're all pulled up really tight and high, they wanted to be like the corn.
I can also then see why people also get into that Ancient Aliens bullshit too then.
Yes, 100%.
And it's like, you know, you wouldn't go if it was aliens if you wouldn't you read a freaking book about how much corn meant to them.
So the ancient Maya concept of deity or divinity is more than just animism or personification of natural phenomenon. Typically, Maya gods are fluid and have diverse personalities. This seems to make it very difficult to distinguish one god from another. But it can be simpler to keep in mind, although they're numerous, the most consequential gods sometimes morph with less notable ones and share characteristics. So it can be a little hard to pinpoint, wait, is this about the creator spirit here or is it the trickster person over here?
Maybe it's both.
The incorporation of connectivity in Maya culture, not surprisingly, applies to the Maya deities as well. So they even have conflicting personality traits. The multiplicity of the deities' personalities are furthered by their appearance. Many gods are an amalgamation of human and a particular animal. They're also associated with different cardinal directions. The individual god's importance can vary depending on historical context. And this fluidity is why some scholars actually refer to them with letters of the Latin alphabet. So if you see a listing, they'll call them like XY and stuff like that. It's because it's hard to keep track of it. The life cycle of the maize lies at the heart of the Maya belief, but the role of the principal maize god goes beyond agriculture to embrace aspects of life in general, like writing.
Yeah.
So you would think, oh, you're the god of corn. You only have to do with corn or growing things. No, it doesn't. So they have all different sort of social functions, agriculture, midwifery, trade, war. But like I said, they change these attributes. You have a principal creator god, sky god, sun god, patron of the Venus cycle, gods of the weather and crops, the rain god, aged deities of the underground, water, thunder, gods guarding natural resources.
And when you say like the Venus cycle, you mean like Venus the planet?
Venus the planet cycle. All the cycles and stuff are also related with their gods, but it's also related to their planting, but it's also related to their rituals and what they do in their everyday life. So it's very complicated when you're trying. I'm only wanting to talk about this one topic because you end up just mushing them all together.
Basically, it's a company org chart that looks like an infinity symbol overlapped dozens of times.
Very much so. Quote, "3 days ago, Bobo Fish took the dog called Owl Dog to the shrine of the divine Ikcha, there to be given as a blood sacrifice to the cacao-born god of travelers. We were all distressed. How could he do this? Divine Ikcha particularly wants dogs of the color of roasted cocoa beans, and the boatmen, guides, must have no debts to Ikcha, or travel is not safe. The Maya saw life as a continuum of cycles of creation and destruction that would mark the next 52 years, which is why ritual sacrifice was so important to them. Mm. The Maya saw blood as sacred and a potent source of nourishment for their deities, and to sacrifice a living creature meant the highest of prize to the gods, and human life was the ultimate offering, culmination of many annual ceremonies and rituals. Sacrificing rituals were a way of bringing political and religious leaders into alignment too. Like any theocratic society, the Maya political and religious elites mutually reinforced each other's roles with ritual sacrifice, functioning as a performative centerpiece of communal mixing. But when it comes to conflicts of interest between different social groups about sacrifice, including within these elites, the historical record so far has been silent. Mm. So I think a lot of times when we look at things like sacrifice with our Western lens, we're just like, oh no, blah, blah, blah. But I think we also have to understand many of the accounts of how sacrifice was being enacted. It's usually coming from conquistadors mm-hmm. and also Catholic religious leaders at the time who are trying to really emphasize and paint the worst possible potential picture and image of the situation to therefore justify why these people need to stop doing all their religious practices because they're barbarians and they're terrible people.
Yeah.
Whereas like,
even though, you know,
it's different when it's different when I'm killing you because of the love of Christ, you know, kind of thing.
Not sacrificing is a relatively new concept.
Very much so.
And even then, sacrifice is still at the center of, like, Christianity as a concept, which is, like, something that people don't really go into. Like,
look at Jesus, y'all. Quote, Mutel 1, but the nine gods of death only asked for flowers as a finishing sacrifice. This was how the scoring went, a good sign. So the leader was not beheaded. Instead, he went to the ancestors' red house with Lord Yikin and scattered petals and drops of his blood. One of the mythological tales involves god Hunhapalus, who became the maze god. He was tricked into descending the underworld, where he was challenged to a ball game and lost to the Lord of Death. They chopped off his head as punishment. Echoing this tale, the Maya ball game was a matter of life and death. The rules are quite simple. The players, all male, working in teams of two or three, have to get a rubber ball through a ring high up in the hall, but you're not allowed to use your hands. And the game wasn't for the faint of hearted. The rubber ball could also be a lethal weapon, weighing anywhere from 0.5 to 3.5 kilograms and measuring between 10 to 30 centimeters in diameter, it could easily break bones.
I have to go and admit a most grievous error on my part. I do know a little bit more about the Maya.
Because of Roger El Dorado? Get out of here.
There's a very climactic scene with a ball game, and suddenly it all came back to me.
Tulio and Miguel. Miguel and Tulio.
Awesome and powerful gods. Can't do it today. Nope.
Stars. Can't do it. Not today. Yeah, pretty much. So, but the game had religious significance with the captain of the losing team, or sometimes the entire team, were sacrificed to the gods. But this wasn't necessarily how it was done all the time. Mm. It's just in popular myth or what we like to talk about is, and then they killed like the losing team. And it's like, not necessarily. It wasn't always about having to literally lead to the actual ultimate sacrifice of killing people. Sometimes just little drops of blood is enough.
Yeah.
Anyways, on to the more pleasant things. Mm-hmm. Food!
Excellent. The only thing I fundamentally care about.
Quote, we have eaten much turkey, corn, stewed pumpkin with allspice and black bean soup, steamed howler and bitter chocolate, and hot chili sauce, and my favorite, iguana cutlets wrapped with epazo herb and green corn dough, tender corn leaf baked in a pit oven. If I looked as though I would feel, I would look like a pumpkin. All the big people are sleeping late thanks to the holy honey beer they drank by the canoeful all night long. The Maya relied on the three sisters, squash, beans, corn. And using food science, they realized that when they grew all of them together, they could actually help each other grow and develop.
It's like in Weetmo.
Yeah. So tall, viney beans would climb up the maize, and the squash helped reduce soil erosion. The soil is actually not that nutrient rich, so that's where they would employ slash and burn techniques and also let their fields go fallow for a couple of years because trying to get that nutrients back. For millennia, careful astronomical observations have guided the cycle of planting of the corn, the Maya's staple crop, in the same way that their ancestors watched the movement of the sun. Today, many Maya farmers still use their knowledge of the sky to plan the agricultural cycle of the corn and plan for the best times to plant and conduct their offerings and ceremonies. By observing the natural cycles that link the earth and sky, they have constructed a worldview of the universe where time is cylindrical and all things are interconnected. They also consumed a lot of meat too. Turkey, wild boar, deer, fish, and what seems more exotic to us, armadillos, tapirs, monkeys, and manatees even. They were also beekeepers, and they sweetened their maize with honey. Their cacao drink may have only been part of important rituals and ceremonies. The bean was so highly valued, it was actually used as currency instead of silver and gold, which they deemed pretty worthless.
Dang.
Many popular dishes today actually have ancient Mayan roots. While Mayan dishes back then would have not looked the same way, the influence and inspiration are still taken from a time when people weren't aware of how their diets were actually shaping the future. So if you've enjoyed corn tortillas, tamales, hot cup of chocolate, quite a few things actually that you would think as staples now, especially now that the explosion of quote unquote authentic Mexican cuisine has taken off, a lot of these are actually Maya dishes. So yes. It's kind of cool that way. Family and community organization. Quote.
We're moving on from the food right away.
Yes. That's all I have to say about food because it leads into the role of women and men in society.
Okay, fine, fine.
So, quote. Women cannot get anywhere near the weapons. If we touch a spear accidentally, it would grow weak. I suppose that's because spears have to go straight, their blade cutting true. But women's power is like the shuttles, weaving things together. Quote, he explained my new title. I would be the Lady Yash-Oshak, the new king's wife, who reads for him, who counts for him. I will not be the one who oversees his feasting. I will not be the one who oversees his clothing, who weaves and washes for him.
I mean, personally, I would not like to go and be that either, so good for her.
Yeah, I'd rather be the righty one instead of the washy one.
Mm-hmm.
So the Maya were family-centered. During the classic period, the social structure began to get more complex and hierarchical. Men and women usually performed different tasks, males producing food by agricultural labor and helping women make babies, but women processed the products of the field and made them edible. In addition to raising deer when necessary, women had religious responsibilities relating to household ritual. They held important roles in this aspect of life. While young boys were being taught hunting, women were trained in domestics and how to keep religious shrines as well.
This just makes you think about how for the hunter-gatherer mythos, I mean, that we have around like certain indigenous groups versus like the more settled ones, is that anthropologists have figured out that male hunters brought in like less than 20% of the caloric makeup of the diet. Because hunting was just seen to be almost like a waste of time in a way, because you could spend so many days and so much food going out hunting for something.
And not get anything.
But then another thing, too, is that you go and you take down a deer, and if you go and you preserve it and take care of it, the meat, that can go and last you for over a month. So you don't actually have to go out and do it that often.
Yeah.
But women who are tending the fields or gathering and doing the foraging, that was where the bulk of the diet came from.
Yeah, and they were primarily focused on agriculture, but the biggest thing was like the preparation and care of the food, that was the women's role. And so it doesn't matter if you can grow a field of corn if you don't have a woman to make you be able to eat it. It's that give and take of understanding the way that the roles are.
Well, and also too, it's like this whole like the mighty hunter who protects and defends his family is just... it's a construct and it actually is a waste of time.
Yeah.
90% of it. So.
Yeah. So women were associated with the ritual practice of religion as well as the beliefs. The moon goddess was one of the most prominent gods in the Maya Parthenon.
Ixchel.
Yeah. Through her relations with the other gods, she actually produced the Maya population. So local rulers claim descent from the moon goddess. So it's a pantheon of gods and a woman is a predominant part of that pantheon.
Yes.
Ancient Maya women also, like I said, had an important role in society. Beyond propagating the culture through the bearing and raising of children, they participated in the economic, governmental, farming activities. They also worked on all the textiles, an essential resource and product for the society. And the status of the women can also be inferred from their burials and textual and monumental history. Maya societies included the Tamina, a city which developed a matrilineal system of hereditary hereditary descent after the death and reign of a powerful leader, Lady Kalal. She had assumed the mantle of power after the failure of two male leaders. She's actually a very interesting figure. I'd recommend that you look her up. And actually, when I was reading about her, I had a moment of being like, well, why don't we talk about her?
I was just literally thinking that as you were mentioning. I was like, she sounds super cool. But I'd love to have read a royal diary about her.
Yeah, I know. So speaking of reading and writing a royal diary, let's talk about reading and writing.
That was an amazing segue.
Thank you.
Like, you really were of a, oh crap, this is my exit.
Yep. Quote, Lady Cotton Blossom has helped me pack for my paper, my inks, my brushes, quills, and reed pens. The box was a gift from the Coromant's mother, Lady Cedar Jaguar Claw, and the box is well made. Thin sheets of tortoise shell and an outer case of tapir leather painted thick with rubber sap. You must always keep your books safe, the holy writing safe. You will read them to your husband. Let them give him something new to think on. He will be glad you have come to him. You will give him portions of the world he has not seen. You must look with hungry eyes and write whatever things are dry enough so your writings will not dissolve. The Maya writing system is considered by archaeologists to be one of the most sophisticated systems ever developed in Mesoamerica. They wrote 800 individual signs or glyphs paired in columns that read together from the left to right, bottom to top. Maya glyphs represented words or symbols that could be combined to form any word or concept in the language, including numbers, time, periods, royal names, titles, dynastic events, names of gods, scribes, scholars, objects, buildings, places, food. Hieroglyphic inscriptions were either carved in wood or stone on monuments and architecture or painted on paper, plaster walls, and pottery. The unit of the Maya writing system is the glyphic cartouche, which is the equivalent to the words and sentences of modern language. Maya cartouches include at least 3 or 4 glyphs, as many as 50. Each cartouche contained various glyphs with prefixes and suffixes. There is technically no Maya alphabet. So their writing is difficult to interpret for a number of reasons. First of all, they don't represent just a sound or an idea. They can represent both, making it difficult to know what the glyph or cartouche should read. In addition, many Maya glyphs have more than one meaning, and Maya concepts can be written in more than one way. Numbers can be written as numerical symbols, or the picture of the god associated with that number, or a combination of the two.
You know, I've been trying to teach myself Arabic on Duolingo.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay. So now I'm going from right to left. And it's, you know, the combo of certain things and all of that. I think I'm getting it. If I saw that, I would probably just like, why is she projectile vomiting? I'm like, too much stress. Can't do it. Won't do it. What if you went and you spent like 50 years of your life trying to go and translate 5 Maya tablets, and then some jackass walks in and says, oh, I think this means actually blah, blah, blah. And suddenly everything changes, but that could actually happen. That sounds like that probably did happen. I'm feeling anxious and stressed for anybody who's currently now lying in bed thinking, I have to go back and keep on translating those tablets in the morning. Oh, God.
God bless.
Oh.
So, for example, the name of the Palakin ruler Pakal, whose name literally means hand shield, appears sometimes as a picture of a hand shield, sometimes phonetically as Pakala, and other times as a combination of pictures and phonetics. So imagine you're trying to read an account, and maybe in the same account, they've decided to showcase his name in one of these multiple ways. And so then you're like, we're still talking about the same guy. So after this,
I feel
a lot better and a little more gracious. And when I was feeling frustrated about these names, is this a place? Is this a person? Is this a thing? I'm like, this level of confusion is an accurate level of confusion.
The feel for it. Like, this is truly a well-integrated.
It's very well-integrated. So the Maya considered writing to be a sacred gift from the gods. Most ancient Maya could not read because knowledge of reading and writing was jealously guarded by a small elite class who believed that they alone could directly interact with the gods and mediate between them and the common people.
Like, that's not surprising to me. Also, but at the same time, if I was just minding my business, you know, farming my cacao and just living my life, and someone said, would you like to go and try and translate these 5 tablets?
Would you like to learn to read? And I looked at it, I'd be like, no. So following the arrival of the Spanish in the 16th century, many Maya dictionaries, glossaries, and prayer books appeared. These are important resources in the interpretation of these hieroglyphics. Maya also learned in the 16th century to record their languages using Roman letters, and later Maya works do not feature hieroglyphic writing, but phonetically rendering of the Maya language in Roman script. So there was a terrible priest who decided to show up and say, you know, we got to get rid of these evil religious writings and blah, blah, blah.
So terrible priest? I'm so shocked.
So he took all this stuff after he had someone basically translate a couple of their predominant holy books. And then he was like, thank you very much. Now I will get rid of your demon book. But he took those copies and they're off in Spain. Well, inadvertently, his collection ends up becoming this wonderful, like, saving of this language and culture, which because of after only a few elites and blah, 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 it's like the people die out. And if it's not being passed on because it's being eradicated because of genocide, like culturally and like literally, then it'd be like lost forever. So in a weird way, I'm like, thank you, horrible priest man, but like not thank you.
I mean, I think that it's a really nice, delicious irony.
It is It is irony. I've done your work, God. I've gotten rid of the heathen book. Thank you, priest man. You actually ended up saving this language.
You are helping that poor guy who's trying to translate those five tablets and that one cacao farmer said, no, thank you.
No, thank you. So
I feel really attached to these characters that we've developed.
I know. That's the power of storytelling for sure. So let's talk about Maya cities. Quote, arriving from the west, we could see the new holy pyramid mountain. Yakin has been built long before we came to the heart of the city. I saw something red high up. It was a roof comb. In a style not as graceful as the open crestwork we have at our roofs of Lamca, but a rather solid blunt slab. It's sculpted and painted with a portrait of the great sun lord of Mutal, just as our high houses are adorned with the reliefs of my forebears. Then we came along a white paved road and saw how tall the new mountain really stands. It seems as though the ancestor's house doesn't have enough doors, only one instead of three. It's a strange way to design a temple. The chamber where I sleep has walls painted turquoise blue. Every bit of wood beam and door frame is charmingly carved with images of trees, spirit animals, and gods watching over us all.
I also appreciate this because it's like the antithesis of the white walls minimalism that I'm just so sick and tired of in terms of interior decorating.
Yeah, like bring back those carvings, bring back like the bright colors and painting.
I am a maximalist and I am okay with that.
So the classic Maya period, which began in roughly around 250 AD, the golden age of the empire, it included some 40 cities, including Tikal, Yuxitan, Copan, Bonampan, Pac, Dos Piles, Camacol, Palakic, Riobec, and each city had a population between 5,000 and 50,000 people. At its peak, the population may have reached around 2 million to as many as 10 million.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. So excavations of these sites have unearthed plazas, palaces, temples, pyramids, as well as the famous ball courts. The cities were surrounded and supported by large populations of farmers. Even though they practiced slash and burning agriculture to help enrich the soil, they also displayed evidence of more advanced farming methods like irrigation and terracing because of the terrain. The cities were always spaced apart as opposed to the Aztecs. There's, like I said, no real Maya kingdom. Mm-hmm. Because their power wasn't centralized, this probably is actually why they lasted longer as a civilization. Mm-hmm. At the time of the Spanish showing up, there were 16 rival city-states or provinces, because where the Aztecs only had one centralized seat of power, what's now Mexico City, the Maya weren't easy to capture. It took nearly two centuries for the Maya to be quote-unquote subdued, and in some ways, though, this is still happening. Mm. Cut to the decline of the Mayas. This is actually a misnomer because it's more like they had reduced the cities and cultural hubs and changed, and there were population declines from around 900 to 1000 AD. There are many theories about how and why this happened. Maybe some external, maybe some internal. External factors could have included foreign invaders from the west disrupting their society as it led to its decline. Different tribes from Mexico pushing into Central America. But there's not a lot of evidence for that theory. Another potential theory, trade changes. Instead of overland treks, people started to utilize maritime routes. So large landlocked cities like Tikal, Caralco, and Calamar normal were bypassed, so eventually that led to the collapse of their economies. Internal factors could have also played a role, with people rising up to overthrow leaders, but there's little factual evidence of this. Natural catastrophes like volcanoes, earthquakes, epidemics have also been blamed, but there's little geological evidence. There could have been more ecological problems like a prolonged drought. With the growing population and more mouths to feed and more resources needed to create sources of food. But by clear-cutting too much of the forest, there was actually changing climate that led to the drought that leads to malnutrition, and people are leaving the cities looking for food. Studies of lake sediments in southern Yucatan, Belize, and Petén show evidence of very long periods of dry weather at this time. But we need to note, not all of the Maya cities collapsed. Many continued to thrive on the riversides and kept connections with northern cities. But that later led to their problems with Spanish conquistadors.
This just kind of makes me go and think about how, quote unquote, like dark ages, so we just like assumed existed for a period of time, but it turns out that they actually weren't the type of dark ages that we thought they were. We just hadn't had like the archaeological digs yet.
Mm-hmm.
So like the answer is going to be found at one point, but also, I mean, all places have like their ups and their downs.
Yeah, it's
and
like
their
a
decline.
Boom and bust. So
and look at the Rust Belt in America.
I was just gonna say, a lot of these places, people left because the industry dried up. So despite these local differences in more than 30 living languages, the Maya share cultural roots and the common legacy of an accomplished civilization that peaked from about 250 to 1200 CE. The term Maya is a Yucatan Mayan language word that describes the language spoken by indigenous people in the Yucatan Peninsula, Mexico. Western scholars have ascribed this term to all Maya people. Maya culture is characterized by, like I said, the architecture, iconography, hieroglyphic writing, and complex mathematical and astrological systems. Knowledge of the astronomy and sustainable agriculture still guide the daily activities for rural life in the Maya world. Ritual ceremonies connect to their land and their calendar. They are still being practice today.
Mm-hmm.
And Maya people are active participants in the social fabric of an international world. The legacy of their ancestors propels their culture forward. So today, there are an estimated 7 million Maya people still living in southern Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador, and Honduras. We're going to do a quick snapshot of what's the situation like for the Maya people in each one of these countries. Some are good, some not so good. Let's just be honest, probably not so good.
Yep.
Okay. So Mexico. Chiapas was for many years one of the regions in Mexico that was least touched by the reforms of the Mexican Revolution. The Zapatista Army of National Liberation launched a rebellion against the Mexican state Chiapas in January 1994, declaring itself to be an indigenous movement and drew its strongest and earliest support from Chiapas Maya. Since 1994, this group has nominally been at war with the Mexican state, although it's described as a point of frozen conflict. In recent years, the EZLN has focused on a strategy of civil resistance. Zapata's main body is made up of rural indigenous people, but it includes supporters in urban areas and internationally. Their main spokesperson is Subcommandant Insurgent Galeano. Unlike other Zapatista spokespeople, Marcos is not an indigenous Maya. While the EZLN ideology is similar to libertarian socialism, the Zapatistas have rejected and defied political classification. They align themselves with wider ultra-globalization, anti-neoliberal social movement, seeking indigenous control over local resources, especially land. Since their 94 uprising was countered by Mexican armed forces, they have abstained from military offensives and adopted a new strategy that attempts to garner Mexican and international support.
I knew about them, by the way, and that's not just because of Rage Against the Machine.
Another story. So in Guatemala, civil war was fought from 1960 to 1996, and it left more than 200,000 people dead, 500,000 driven from homes, and at least 100,000 women raped. Most victims were Maya.
Of course.
The context of the struggle is based on the long-standing issues of unfair land distribution, European descended residents, and foreign companies such as the American United Fruit Company has dominated control over the land, leading to conflicts with rural poor. The genocide against the Mayan people took place throughout the Civil War because indigenous people were seen as supporting leftist guerrillas. Most acts against humanity occurred during Efrén Roriz Montes' presidency from 1982 to 1983. He instituted a state of terror intending to destroy the Mayas in the name of countering communist subversion and ridding the country of its indigenous culture. This was known as Operation Sophia. Within Operation Sophia, the military followed through with scorched earth policies, which allowed them to destroy whole villages, including killing livestock, destroying cultural symbols, destroying crops, murdering civilians. In some areas, government forces killed about 40% of the total population. The campaign destroyed at least 626 Maya villages. The CIA-backed problems in Guatemala, like, you need to look that up.
People are like, why are all these people from Central America coming up?
And it's like people are saying, don't come, because we don't have a place for you, you're not welcome. It's like, well, maybe you shouldn't have given guns and ammo so people could ruin our lives and then destroy our home. So I don't have a home. That's why I'm leaving it. So in 2012, the former president was formally indicted in Guatemala for overseeing the massacre of 1,771 civilians of the Ixtel Maya group and appeared in court for genocide and crimes against humanity. Of course, after he was sentenced, the ruling was overturned by a constitutional court over irregularities in handling the case. The ex-president appeared in court again in 2015. They deliberated that the retrial proceedings could find Rios Montt guilty or not, but the sentence was suspended. He died of a heart attack in 2018. So far, America has not been called to account for its participation in this horrific war crime. What? Who said that? In El Salvador, according to the Salvadorian government, about 1% of the population are full or predominantly indigenous origin. The largest, most dominant native Salvadorian groups are the Lencha people and the Pipel people, followed by small enclaves of Maya peoples. The official number of indigenous people has been criticized by indigenous organizations and academics as too small, and many accuse the government of denying their existence of indigenous Salvadorians in the country. Very few Amerindian Indians have retained their customs and traditions, having over time been assimilated into the dominant Mestizo Spanish culture. The low numbers of indigenous people may be partially explained by historically high rates of old world diseases, absorption into the Mestizo population, as well as mass murder during the 1932 Salvadorian peasant uprising. The massacre saw estimates of up to 30,000 peasants killed in a short period of time. Many authors note that since this massacre, the indigenous in El Salvador have been very reluctant to describe themselves as such in census declarations, for example, or to wear indigenous dress or being seen to take part in any cultural activities or customs that could be perceived as indigenous. In Honduras, the Maya Chitori are descendants of the people who inhabited the capital of the ancient Mayan Empire of Copan in Honduras. They now live in the departments of Copan and Otepectic. And according to the 2013 census, there were roughly around 33,000 people who identify as Maya. In conjunction with the more numerous and well-organized Lenca to the south, these Maya have for decades demanded that the centralized government return nearly 35,000 acres to indigenous people as promised in the 18th century agreement with the Spanish colonial government.
We've been promising that indigenous people will have clean water and not have uranium poisoning for decades now. I mean, they can wait a little bit longer. That was sarcasm.
Yes, of course. Drink this water with gasoline, people in Iqaluit. What do you mean you're out of bottled water? So this has put the number of Maya indigenous rights activists at great risk, as evidenced by the assassination of two leaders, Candento Adamor and Ovidio Perez, in 1997. The Maya have stated that both men were killed by order of local landowners. The Honduran police have made arrests and laid criminal charges, but many observers believe that justice has not been served and those really responsible will not be held accountable.
Of course.
In 1997, in response to massive protests by indigenous community groups, including a blockade of the Maya ruins of Copan, the Honduran government signed a legal agreement with the Maya for a titling of 14,700 hectares of land, but it's since failed to deliver fully on that promise. Mm-hmm. According to a 2016 report by UN Special Rapporteur of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, only 4,995 hectares have been registered with the community. Since 1997, the Maya have blockaded the entrance to the ruins numerous times. In 2000, after a four-day blockade, Honduran army tear gassed the protesters in a low-flying helicopter despite an agreement to end the occupation. The injured, those including those who were imprisoned, were denied medical treatment until a human rights lawyer effected their release. Meanwhile, private individuals have managed to secure land titles and obtain judicial orders to evict Maya from their ancestral lands.
Of course.
On to Belize. It's often referred to the heart of the Maya. It boasts the highest concentration of Maya sites along all the Central American countries. The Maya were in Belize prior to the first millennium, although they have suffered through years of numerous persecutions. Of the 28 Maya ethnic groups that exist today, those that are currently present in Belize are the Yucatec, Mopan, and the Cocachi Maya, who are located in the south of the country. The current issues affecting the indigenous community of Belize are mainly related to continued encouragement of the government of Belize of non-indigenous settlement, large-scale logging, and petroleum development in traditional Maya lands, despite the stated intentions to address these matters. This not only continues to threaten their communities, but the natural environment upon which their culture and livelihood depend. This has prompted Maya communities to work with local Belizean attorneys and support groups to reach out internationally to organizations like the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program at the University of Arizona, the Indian Law Resource Center, and the University of Toronto Human Rights Law Clinic for legal assistance. Their aim was to initiate international litigation in support of their outstanding claims. In May 2015, the Caribbean Court of Justice, the CCJ, affirmed the rights of the Maya people of southern Belize to their customary and traditional lands. The ruling included an agreement between the Maya and the representatives of the government of Belize, previously held by Belize's Court of Appeals, and confirmed their traditional land is their property under the Constitution. The CCJ accepted the government's undertaking to put into place in full consultation with the Maya. Importantly, the failure by the government to take these steps to implement the earlier judgments in favor of the Maya, the CCJ said it would oversee the government's compliance.
They could take the reservation, but they couldn't hold the reservation.
Yes. Unfortunately, by 2017, there's little sign of actual implementation. So, and it's a way of commemorating International Day of World's Indigenous People and the 10th anniversary of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, the SATIIM, so an Indigenous activist group, took matters into their own hands and launched a Maya Land Rights Registry in order to implement these findings.
Excellent.
So in an effort to protect and preserve a rich cultural heritage, Belize, Mexico, and Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador came together to establish Mundo Maya in the late 1980s. The Mundo Maya organization aims to position its region, once home to the ancient Maya, as a multi-destination. So here we get into heritage tourism.
Yep.
The 1,440-mile architectural and ecological circuit within the borders of these five nations, we have a variety of ecosystems, jungles, highlands, beaches, everything. You name it, you got it. It's also home to more than 200 monumental astronomical complexes that served as the map to the skies. Today, the Maya who inhabit the region are descendants of these scientists, artists, warriors, merchants, and they participate in the creation of tourism. This is where things get sticky. So there is a relationship between cultural heritage, tourism, and national identity. In the case of the Maya, many national identities have been constructed because of the growing demands placed on them by cultural tourism. By focusing on life ways through costume, ritual, diet, handcraft, language, housing, or features, the identity of the economy shifts from the sale of labor to the sale of culture. Global tourism is now considered to be one of the largest scale movements of goods, services, and people in history, and it's a significant catalyst for the economic development and socio-political change. It's estimated that between 35% and 40% of tourism today is represented by cultural tourism or heritage tourism. This alternative to mass tourism offers opportunities for place-based engagement that frames context for interaction of the lived space and everyday life of the people, as well as sites, objects of global historical significance. This product of tourism uses historic symbols, signs, topics to form a new side that characterizes a nation and can play an active role in nation building. With this type of tourism, people argue that ethno-commerce may be opening unprecedented opportunities by creating value of various kinds. Tourists travel with cultural expectations, which creates touristic experience faced with the need to invent traditions of artificial and contrived attractions.
It's kind of like how, let's go and take all these photos of indigenous people, but I'm going to bring the costumes for them to wear.
Yeah. Also developing at the expense of actual local traditions and meanings. An example of this is on Roatan Island in Honduras. It's become increasingly Mayanized over the past decade. Tour operators and developers continue to invent an idealized Maya past for the island. Non-Maya archaeological remains and cultural heritage are constantly being threatened and destroyed. While heritage tourism provides economic opportunities for some, it can devalue the contributions of less familiar groups.
It's a relegation of these people to just the past as well.
Instead of being actual living, breathing modern people. And it's funny because I was in the Yucatan. I did participate in cultural tourism, but I would say one of the most standout things was this was on a giant reserve of land and only slightly parceled off place was for these activities. But the rest of the land was still being cared for and protected by the Maya people. So the way that they had set up this operation was the government said to them, we will give you this huge chunk of land, but you have to maintain it. Well, how can we maintain this and preserve it? Well, if we open up this tourism activity, that's a way we can get money so that we can protect a bigger chunk of land. Also, each single person here is either they're getting to learn a new trade and skill. So there was a young boy, he was the photographer of the trip. It's part of an indigenous outreach program where he's being trained as a photographer, being apprenticed so that if he wants to have another potential source of income in the future, that's an option to him. Because unfortunately, because of the very real reality of global warming, climate change, like, and a bunch of other things, you can't be wholly rely on agriculture anymore. So what's going to be this kid's future / side hustle?
Yeah.
Also, there's discrimination.
He's indigenous.
He's indigenous. And that exists out there. So it isn't like I did, quote unquote, the good type of tourism, but there is something about how they said to us, this is the reality. This is what we're doing. Also, while you're here, before you jump into a cenote, we're going to take the time to explain to you what is the religious significance of a cenote, because there is no rivers, there are no running waters, it's all underground. And so it is a perfect encapsulation of that whole thing of, in a cenote, you have life because there's water, but it's also death because it's a cave full of water. And if you're in it and you can go into a hole, you're gone. We had someone talk to us about that significance, and there actually was a shaman there who took us through religious ritual of purification before we could even go in the water. This isn't a question of we're doing this for a gimmicky touristy thing. This is what we genuinely believe. And before you do this, we're asking you to engage in this.
Yeah.
And so you could be cynical and say like, oh, that was just a very touristy, trappy thing. But considering that 15, 20 years ago, this guy probably wouldn't have been allowed to do this at all publicly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a turning point. If it's just based off of commodifying your culture and religion in order to survive as a people, like, that's not good enough.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to put out your religious practices on display just because that's the only option you have for a source of income potentially.
That's also where who is directing and who's trying to make what legible. There's this one film from the early 90s called like El Norte, and it's also like set in Guatemala. It's about two siblings, a brother and a sister, who have to leave because they're indigenous and everything's falling apart. And you see them travel up from Mexico, and then has like they think they're going to have the American dream and finally make it, but they're not allowed to exist in America. Of course, like it ends in tragedy. Even though the story was by an indigenous person from Guatemala, it was still directed and adapted by a British director. Whereas like that money funding actually going to, it was going back to BFI, right, who produced it. But now in like new Guatemalan cinema, you go and you have its Guatemalan directors, indigenous writers, and it's being produced within like their own film and production companies. It's even being done within like their indigenous languages too, right? So it's still, in a sense, some parts of it are getting taken back.
It wasn't just, we've hired you at this tourist operation. It's, we own this tourist operation. And we are deciding this is what we're doing so that we can, bigger picture, protect a larger part of our land, which we need to be able to take care of. It's the same kind of idea there.
Yeah.
That's sort of the crash course into the Maya of the past, who aren't really in the past. I hope after what I've told you, has it done its job as sort of like a gateway or an opening to learning more about these people. And Yash Ashok is sort of a standing conduit to show people pre-contact. But I think because there is so little known about her, and from what I've encountered in the educational system, for me, this book fell short because of my personal ignorance. And how many times do we not want to engage with something because of our own shortcoming, and we put it on the book, or we put it on someone or something else?
I definitely want to reread it, and I didn't go and share my one sticky note.
Oh, Julia's one sticky note.
I just thought that this is really beautiful, because this is what her sister says to her when they're leaving each other. Until death, then, if we do not meet again sooner, may we meet again sooner. Know my face. It is one that sees you faithfully, one that hears you even when you speak quietly. Know my face. It is one that talks to you truthfully. Know my heart. It is one that loves you. And I just thought that was really beautiful.
And I feel like, in a way, that's like what all the Maya people are saying to us.
Yeah, they know us.
Yeah, get to know us.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.